Hello, my name is Jeremy Melder, and I'm the presenter from Beaming Green. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge that this podcast is being held on the traditional lands of the Bundjalung people and pay our respects to elders both past, present and emerging. The Beaming Green podcast is a weekly podcast which will help you to take out some of the stress and confusion about how to live your life more sustainably. And we do this by introducing you to people that have first-hand experience and expertise in all aspects of sustainability, so you can get some amazing insights of how you can implement simple and practical solutions to enhance your life and the lives of your family. Welcome to Beaming Green's first ever podcast. Today I'd like to introduce you to synthropic agriculture, a concept I learnt about 3 years ago with Victor Perez. Victor's born in Brazil and has spent 20 years living in Australia. Along with a friend, he introduced synthropic agriculture to Australia in early 2016, hosting 3 workshops near Byron Bay. Victor has trained with the most experienced practitioners, including the founder, Ernst Gotch. Victor is also the co-founder of Gabala Farms, the first synthropic farm in Australia. For the past 20 months, he and his partner have been applying synthropic farming principles on severely degraded land in Yukai, New South Wales. So I would like to now introduce you to Victor Perez. Welcome, Victor.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeremy.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. A bit of a long journey, jumping on a plane when I was 17 years old just to come to Australia to learn English and kind of stayed a little bit longer than planned. And it's been, close to 19 years since I've been here. So I'm kind of half Aussie, half Brazilian at the moment.
It seems like you learned English pretty well.
Well, yes, at university. But I'm kind of in that stage that, you know, the English is not perfect and the Portuguese is kind of disappearing as well. So it's kind of not really sure where I belong.
Yeah. So we're here to talk about synthropic farming, which is something that you're quite passionate about.
Pretty much, yeah.
How did you get involved in that? How did that start? Did it start in Brazil or did it start in Australia?
Yeah. Look, I think it's been a long journey. I guess I've done environmental science at UNE and environmental planning. So there was always an environmental background on my interests. I didn't seem to have found too many answers at university. And in 2005, I actually went back to Brazil for a year after my bachelor's degree and did quite a few permaculture courses over there, which was really kind of an eye-opener. It was, this seems like a good pathway to go on, but life got a bit busy as I came back here doing other things. But the food production was always there. There was always an interest in producing more food. Did my PhD on trying to help urban agriculture on the Gold Coast, but more towards the policy-making kind of side of things. And then kind of moved on into owning a coffee shop. Not quite the side of food production that I was kind of aiming at. Yeah. But at that time, interesting enough, I did another course, a production horticulture course at Wollombar TAFE.
Yep.
I had a little house in Ocean Shores, and I just turned that front yard into as many fruit trees as I could put in. So there was about 150 square meters and there was probably 80 trees in it. And right at that time, the Life in Syntropy movie or documentary came out.
Yep.
And that kind of connected a few dots for me that I was already trying to connect by myself, how do you put all those trees together?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there was a bit of structure to it,
yeah.
how to do it. And then I kind of went to Brazil. It was a bit frenetic. I went to Brazil like 3 times in a row, did 10 courses over there, kind of met all the big guns. And
the big guns being like Ernst, is that right? Ernst,
yeah.
who's the Swiss farmer that's living in Brazil.
Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience with Ernst? Tell me that you've done a course with him and
yep.
had some trainings from some of his, what would you call them, his disciples?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, let's say Ernest is perhaps, you know, tier one, the kind of the founder. I mean, I don't know if I like the word founder, but he's the person that put all those theories together, sure, in a way that works. You know, he's definitely didn't do it by himself. And then there is tier two, those people that have been, you know, playing with him for, let's say, 20 years. People like Patricia Vaz and Namaste and Juan and some others around, which I've, kind of had the pleasure to visit them in Brazil, yeah, and have a look at their properties. My first course was with Juan in Sítio Semente in Brasília. Very nice. I mean, if you have seen the Life in Sintropy movie, his farm is one of the most featured in there, those aerial footages of nothing growing and then a little square of trees. That's kind of his place. Yeah. And with Ernest, yeah, I've done one course with him at Henrique's property, that's in Bahia as well, called Fazenda Ouro Fino, which is a stunning display of biodiversity and food, and it's just amazing. Mm. And it was great. I mean, the guy's a bit of a genius, perhaps not the easiest one to deal with. You know, I think like most geniuses, they perhaps...
man on a mission sort of thing. Yeah.
Man on a mission, and perhaps a few too many steps ahead of us.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I did go and actually visit his farm as well, and it's just amazing. And yeah, the guy's a bit of a machine, and chopping and managing and just, putting things together.
So in terms of putting, if you were to try to explain it to someone, you know, that's never heard of Sintropy, how would you explain it? Like, what would you call it? Like, is it like permaculture? Is there a big difference between permaculture and Sintropy?
Yeah. Look, permaculture to me is such a broad art culture. You know, it involves so many facets. So I think syntropic farming could be a facet of it, you know, in terms of that food forest concept that Bill Mollison and the other boys have put it together. But I think it takes a step further. I mean, my understanding of the food forest is a little bit loose, whereas syntropic farming is very, let's say, practical. There is a lot of steps, there's a lot of strategies that you put in place to get where you want to be. So basically, it's about playing with life, playing and understanding what are the rules behind nature, you know, where nature's trying to go. And you basically try to understand that and then try to go with it, which is kind of contrary to most other types of farming, in which we are just simply imposing on nature where we want to go. And most often than not, it's kind of, you're kind of going towards opposite directions. So if in tropic farming, we try to understand where nature is going, and basically is to generate more life. That's the basis of it. Everybody can continue to evolve. And when you go down to that, more life means more photosynthesis, more water, more capture of sunlight. So basically, that's why we try to work with. It doesn't matter if your land is super degraded or a rainforest, you're always moving towards more life. So, and then there is a number of steps or strategies or things that you can do to go there or to move in that direction with nature.
Yeah, I met you, I think it was nearly 3 years ago now, we had an introduction to Sintropy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the first time I'd actually seen what you were doing in terms of, you know, building a syntropic farm. That was with Scott.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the listeners, you know, there were gum trees and banana plants, and there was multiple layers, if you like, or rows of plant life. Now, does this system give you more food production in a smaller area, or what's achieving by doing this polyculture?
Yeah. So basically, you know, going back to principle number one, which is, you know, let's have as much photosynthesis as possible. So with that, then we start to play with time and space. which is, you know, stratification, as you were talking about, is kind of the space or light requirement of plants. And then succession or life cycle of the plants, you start to play with the time factor. So basically, it's how can we have as much photosynthesis in both time and space? And so for that, you need a combination of plants that you both have, you know, different life cycles. So you, lettuces, there might be, you know, 3-4 weeks there, and bananas, that will be 2 years, and gums, there might be, you know, 15 years, and bunny pines, there might be, who knows, 300 years. So that's kind of the time factor. And then with the space factor, you can have, you know, plants that requires a lot of sun, like one of those gum trees, and you can have plants that requires a little bit less, perhaps like an avocado, might be a high or a medium high strata, and you can come down to a coffee or to a citrus, which might be towards more the medium or the medium low strata, and you can have those ground covers. And so, I mean, there are more stratas than that, but, you know, we usually we deal with four, kind of the emergent, the high, the medium, and the low. And we try to compose our garden or our farm with as many of those as possible. So it becomes much more productive because you have production coming at all times, let's say, and there are many more of that. But if you're going to say, you know, if you want to compare a monoculture of coffee with a syntropic system of coffee, are you going to have more coffee? Quantity-wise, you're probably going to have less coffee because you're going to have less coffee trees. But quality-wise, you're going to have a much better quality coffee with a much more resilient tree, and you're going to have a diverse amount of other crops. You know, you can go as simple as just, you know, some coffee, some macadamia, and some pecan nuts. So it's not super complex, but just by having those three other layers, those two other layers, you have a much more resilient crop, you have much more quality produce, and, you know, it's a win-win-win, and you are able to have photosynthesis most time of the year, and you have things, and of course we'll probably add one more type of tree in there, which is what we call a service tree. So, and that's why we use the gum tree so much, because they're such an excellent tree for us to prune.
Now, would that be just in Australia that the gum tree is suitable, or would it work in other countries?
Yeah, I think one of the key things about syntropic farming is that there are no recipes. I mean, everybody say, oh, you have to have bananas and you have to have eucalyptus. I mean, these are just key species because they represent a function. So the eucalyptus, I mean, for us, it's great because it's not only does that function of producing large amounts of biomass, of growing really quick, or having a really strong tap root, and really accepting a lot of pruning, and being native is like, oh, it's kind of a win-win. But really, it's about understanding the function of the trees, and it can be many, many other trees. It can be there's lots of wattles that can do that role. And ideally, you're going to have those service trees throughout time and space as well. And unfortunately, a lot of the service species that we use in those very, very degraded lands are exotic plants because they are the ones that can handle such conditions. But if we have natives that can do it, you know, we have no problem selecting species. We don't have a particular preference for native or exotics. What we want is plants that can deliver the job, that can do it for us, for nature, for whatever. And if it can be native, let's do it. If it can produce food, even better.
Mm.
So, but there is no sectarianism. it is really about moving away from a recipe, moving away from dogmas, and going from, okay, let's understand the environment. Let's understand in which state of life, you know, the amount of life there is in this current environment. And let's try with our knowledge and with different processes, how can we take this forward? And in doing so, producing food. That's the idea.
Yeah. Look, I really think that's so true what you were saying. One of the things that I took out from the course, the introduction course that you did, was it was about observing the land and actually feeling the vibration of the land, you know? And it was also an interesting thing that you were saying that when you cut branches or when you cut trees down that it sends a pulse through the network, so to speak, of the ground. And I've noticed that even on my own land, that when I do cut, that there is a, it does send a signal for growth.
But when we're dealing with something that it's alive and it's moving and it has its own consciousness in a sense, then the only way that you can actually work with that is actually being a part of it and actually observing. And yes, there is a number of principles and strategies that we put in place, but if you are not observing and you're just applying them blindly, then chances are you're not going to be able to conduct that piece of ground to where you think it should be. So everything starts with observation, and everything, and secondary to the observation and, you know, with the interaction with human beings and plants, is that intention of, you know, taking it towards more life. So basically the actions that you take is, okay, I want to take it towards more life. And you can just see once you put, because we planted so dense, that it's inevitable there will be a little bit of tension arising between plants. You know, it's just like when you have a lot of human beings together and you start, you know, once you start touching shoulders, you kind of go, hey, you know, we got a problem. And that's normal. So part of the whole idea is that the human being needs to be present there to release that tension. And so, and that's then understanding, having some knowledge of the plants to say, okay, yeah, that plant has already fulfilled its function. It's time to go. Or this plant is just a service plant, is now impacting on another plant. It's time to go. So pruning is the engine behind the system, is where movement adds. It keeps moving. So you plant a lot, and after, you know, let's say 2, 4, 10 weeks or months, or depends on what you plant, you know, the system starts to create tension. So the human being comes there and prune. And once it prunes, it releases that tension. And what that means is that not only you now have, you know, carbon and plant material laying on the ground, which will slowly degrade and, you know, feed the mycorrhizae, fungal, bacterial network and all that kind of stuff, which is going to be a slow release fertilizer to the plants. But the plant now communicate underground and it starts to release sugars, hormones, growth hormones, and that kind of stuff, which everything else that is there, the things that you have selected to be the next leader, let's call it, to feed off. So it's just that constant interaction of pruning, observing, and guiding. You know, you kind of, the human is kind of a conductor in the system. Okay, you go and you design it with the best of your ability, and it's not going to be perfect. It never will be perfect. Because who knows tomorrow if it's going to be having, you know, 200 millimeters of rain falling or hailstorm or whatever. But the key part is, you know, do the best and be present. Mm. And conduct, you know, interact, ask the questions and be there to listen the answer.
We'll be back in a moment.
My name is Maya and some people know me as the Tooth Fairy. I produce a product called Tooth Tonic, which is a great natural alternative to toothpaste. It's made from selected essential oils that I chose for their oral health-giving properties. 2 drops on a dry toothbrush after flossing will help keep your gums and teeth healthy. Just as healthy plants need healthy soil, healthy teeth need healthy gums. Tooth Tonic comes in 3 optional flavors, mint, fennel, or mint plus. It's plastic free. And to win your free bottle of Tooth Tonic, go to the Beaming Green website and register your name and email address. Winners will be announced at the end of September.
Welcome back. Another thing that I noticed is that you are also, everything's done organically,
mm-hmm.
right? I know you do some, use some fertilizer, but there's no pesticides.
No pesticides.
It's totally organic. I remember you saying about using, you know, all the clippings and everything for mulching.
Yep.
How long do you think, if you've got really poor soil, get, you know, poor soil into reasonably good soil for growth?
Yep. Well, look, there's a number of strategies to go about. I mean, as I've said, so this type of agriculture substitute the recipe for knowledge and processes. So it depends on how fast you want to do it. I mean, if you can work 100% with processes and just understanding where your land is and just trying to bring just the plants that will be able to handle those conditions. And then as they grow and flourish, you cut them and you might be slowly introducing the next generation and the next generation. And then and it, that might take, you know, it really depends how much you want to interact with those plants and how many plants do you actually know, you know. So it's a bit of, time is a bit in relationship to your knowledge and your presence. So it might take, you know, 5-10 years. Or you might just go, okay, I know I want to go a step further and I want to put just a little bit of fertilizers because I don't want, you know, because I don't really want to be dealing with those bracken ferns or those really low successional plants. I just want to step up and let it move. And then you put a little bit of fertilizer, put lots of, you know, perhaps campholoophoras or perhaps some lantanas or some other, you know, gums which do really well. And then start managing them. I mean, it's impossible to say it's going to take you 5 years because there is just so many variables. Or you might be actually go a step further and go like, look, I will actually will feed that soil a fair bit. I will bring a quite a bit of inputs to kickstart. And I will start with my horticulture. So, and that's usually the, perhaps the main strategy that people tend to go towards, in which, so you put all those inputs, you plant your horticulture together with your trees, together with your longer life cycle that you want to take to, I don't know, 20 years, 50 years, depends on your time frame. And then hopefully that horticulture will pay for that system, either, you know, if you're going to sell it or just for you, it's an income, it's your food, you're not spending. And then through management, you take it there. So there is different strategies. The different strategies will determine the time frame. But most important, how often does that human being wants to interact with that? And the more we interact on a conscious way with the intention of bringing life forward, then the faster it will be. And I mean, in some places in Brazil, like Jua's place at Sítio Sementes, I'm not really sure how they come up to that number, but I think it was measuring organic matter in the soil and depth of topsoil and that kind of stuff. Basically, what they're saying that is in 10 years of production, you know, like high productivity in terms of citrus and mangoes and avocados, starting with horticulture, in 10 years, they kind of have moved the life in the soil, what we usually refers to consolidated life, quantity and quality, which would be equivalent to about 100 years of a natural process.
Wow.
So that's gives you an idea, you know, but somebody that is, you know, highly knowledgeable, very hands-on, interact with it on a daily basis and is there producing, extracting good quality food, making a living out of that, and is still speeding up that process that much.
One of the things I just picked up on what you were saying about in Australia, in where we are in New South Wales, campholoral is seen like a weed, but you use this as a plant that actually you exist with in your system.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about that, the theory behind that? Because obviously, you know, there's a ruling that you try to get rid of these weeds and everyone uses pesticides and so on.
Yeah.
How do you see that playing out in your system in terms of coexisting with your plants?
Yeah. Look, everything starts from observation. And in our area, if wherever you look, conflorals are there dominating, not dominating, but they are the species that are leading the way of recovery. They usually come out of, not out of pasture, but it's the kind of a secondary, perhaps behind some sally wattle and some other pioneer plants that pop out of the pasture that we've degraded. So we went there, we degraded the pasture, and now we are blaming one species that is trying to fix our mess, saying that it shouldn't be there, that we actually want a red cedar. And I can tell you, the campholoro would like a red cedar too. So it's working as hard as it can to allow that red cedar to be there, because the way we left, it couldn't. So I think it's actually having a little bit of respect for those plants who are not perfect. You know, they are not the best plants to hold the creek. Definitely not, but they are better than nothing, and they are a lot better than nothing. And it's just respecting, that's one of the principles, is respecting every being that we have there. And the campholoras do such a great job. So does lantana. And, you know, and slowly, of course, the fauna is evolving and lantana is now a habitat for many small birds, small creatures. And there are many, you know, pigeons and things that feed on lantana, on campholoro now. And wild tobacco and all those other plants who are there trying to fix our mess.
Mm.
And in a sense, you know, they are telling you a little bit on how much life that soil has got, you know, like in my land, which is highly degraded. I wish I had more Canfloras and Antenna. I mean, I have bracken ferns, which is really even behind it. It's kind of almost the last line of defense. It's like, all right, even if you cut me, I will stand up.
Yeah.
It's just kind of 100% carbon almost. And so, yeah, I do plant, you know, play with Canfloras. I love the Lantanas. They be such an easy plant to manage. And they generate, you know, a pretty good woody material. It's one of the fastest little woods you can produce. And that's the best thing you can put in the soil, because when wood degrades, you actually get a very stable humus.
Yeah.
And that's the best thing you can have for your red cedar to grow, for your tallow wood to grow, for whatever, you know, for your lettuce to grow, your mango, your avocado, you name it.
Yeah.
That's what we need. It's humus. It's a live, stable, living soil.
Mm.
And if that's going to be created with Lanternum, so be it. If that's going to be created with whatever, Bleeding Hearts or Macaranga, awesome. If you have that, let's use them as well. They, you know, they take, Macaranga is a great plant. I'm working more and more, and I'm part of the challenge perhaps of syntropic farming in Australia as well, is understanding a bit more of those native plants, you know, which functions can they play, how much pruning can they tolerate, you know, which there is, of course, Ernest and all that crew in Brazil with 30, 40 years experience, you know, they have an endless list of plants from every single biome. Here, we're still learning, and that's, you know, would be great to have more and more people, more indigenous people involved, you know, would be amazing.
Absolutely. I think that's a, you know, one thing I'd like to see is more indigenous people involved in this, because there's a lot of knowledge there that they can impart. One of the questions I've got, because, you know, syntropic farming is quite new in Australia, relatively speaking. Yep. In terms of, you know, like where we live, there's lots of sugarcane and, you know, just, you know, monoculture type farming going on. If someone wanted to change from, you know, the hundreds of hectares that they've got or thousands of hectares that they want to go into syntropic farming, can they expect a return, because they're in farming, you know, in the medium term? I'm not saying they're going to get it from day one, but in the medium term, because, you know, depending on what their soil is like and so on, what can they expect? You know, is there any sort of statistics from Brazil that you can impart at all?
Oh, look, I think from everywhere you see, there is always, you know, the response from going from one species, you know, either a monoculture of sugarcane or a monoculture of grass for cattle, and just adding one extra species, usually the return is exponential. I don't have any statistics with sugarcane, but, you know, I have seen reports of people with cattle that have put rows of eucalyptus every, I think, 15 meters or so, and production rose by 30-40% in 2 years. And not only that, I mean, those people, I mean, in Brazil, things like Eucalyptus grandis, our flor de gum here, we have quite a good market for them to sell either as firewood or as posts and things like that. So, and that landowner not only increased 40% on his production in the cattle, but I think, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, he was making more money out of the eucalypts as he put a mill on his property. But the question is, you know, is that person, is that farmer willing to diversify into a different crop? And that's a problem that we constantly find, because the system that we have, you know, our economic system dictates monoculture, because it's already hard enough to grow and sell one culture. And you know how hard the farmers have to work. Once you start introducing a second one and a third one, you know, people go like, oh, how am I going to go into another market? But, you know, I think what I would tell that farmer and everybody else is just do a trial plot, you know, get 500, if you've got 1,000 hectares, you know, get a quarter of a hectare, put a few trees, you know, maybe put a banana beside the sugarcane and a eucalyptus on top, or, you know, play and see how much better it gets or how much more resilient he gets. You know, perhaps you're going to spray less for your sugarcane to control the beetle or any other disease. You know, just do some trials, give it a go, and just see how good it can be. And for the small people, you know, just do 1 square meter. It's as easy as that. Start with one square meter, putting some plants together and see how they interact.
Amazing. Particularly in Australia, or let's look where we are in the north coast of New South Wales. It's now still towards the tail end of winter, although it feels like spring.
Yeah.
What for that person that wants to do a square meter, have you got anything that they could start with, say, tomorrow, that they could start planting in that square meter?
Yeah. Look,
sorry to put you on the spot here, but just
No, I'm just trying to think, what am I going to do? I mean, simple things, of course, a square meter. And one thing that we have to think about is organic matter. How are we going to, for it to be sustainable, idea you produce your own organic matter. And if you have a little bit of lawn around it, a bit of grass, you know, that is a perfect organic matter to cover your soil. So, you know, let's get a little bit of that. Let's put it aside to cover, you know, your square meter, maybe 15 centimeters high, something like that. Doesn't require that much, really. It's one pass with your lawnmower and your catcher, you have plenty there. And, you know, put a few lettuces. Going out maybe in spring, put an okra or maybe some corn as an emergent. Throw a few beans, maybe some tomatoes. Look, just put whatever you can get your hands on. Don't get too worried about, you know, am I doing the right thing?
Yeah.
And then mulch it proper, give it a little water, and observe, and you'll be amazed. I think the important thing is don't put too many lettuces together, because then you have the plant, too many plants with the same function, let's call it, you know. But, you know, space your horticulture like they would in a commercial thing. And then also, if the space of lettuce is every 30 centimeters, keep it to there. But then you have gaps. Put a rocket in the middle of one gap, put a tomato in the middle of the another gap, put some corns here and there, and see what happens. Observe how those plants start to interact. I mean, there's plenty of in the literature there as well, if you want to have a look at what kind of consortiums you want to put it together. Consortiums is what we call, maybe how the permaculture called the guilds.
Yeah,
it's how you kind of play with a little bit of time and space. And give it a go. Maybe don't go too crazy in too many plants, you know, three or four, and just start to observe how they play.
Great. Now, I just wanted to find out, with your life, you know, you guys live on some acreage over there. What are some of the things that you guys do that, you know, sustain you in terms of living your sustainable life?
Yeah, look, I mean, so far I've been very lucky that I've been able to actually put a lot of time and effort researching those systems and trying to bring it to the Australian culture. And my idea when I move into that piece of land, which a friend of ours, was to try and generate and grow a bit of produce to value add. I'm not a big fan of selling fresh produce. I think it's a lot of work to go there into the market on a daily basis and a lot of risk. For me, I like to be a little bit more safe. So my strategy will be to value add and sell a little bit of that. But my passion really is on the educational side and the research side. I mean, I've done a PhD, kind of a researcher by trade kind of thing. And absolutely. I just love to just try new things, you know, get out there and try different little tools, you know, for the small scale. I mean, my scale subsistence, really, that's my passion.
Yeah.
Is can I grow a diverse range of crops for me and my family? You know, in the best possible way, the healthiest way. And that will take, you know, the land that I am at now, which is really degraded, to a much better shape. So when I leave, you know, Steve will go, thank you very much for being here. Mm. And that's kind of part of how we should judge our actions. You know, are we being welcome in that piece of land? So, yeah. So teaching is my passion. Researching is my passion. And, you know, and trying to come up with solutions for some of my problems, which is probably most other people's problem.
Look, I think there's a lot of problems that we're all, you know, encountering in all of that, all aspects of life. I heard a little bit of a rumor.
Yeah.
Right? I heard a rumor that you're percolating.
Yep.
Percolating the possibility of running some courses. Now, if people are, you know, interested in learning a bit about synthropic farming.
Yep.
What would they be able to do? Now, we're going to be putting some details on the website.
Yep.
With, you know, some links and so on to syntropic farming, some videos and things like that that are available mm-hmm. that people can get an idea of what it looks like and so on. I might even put a photo of, you know, what you've done in, yep. in at your place so people get the idea of what you've done. So if people are interested, would it be okay for me to share your email address or Facebook page that you start up to get some interest if people are interested in doing your online course?
Look, absolutely. I mean, it's still brewing. It's a bit of a slow process, I think. I mean, there's nothing that replaces being in a farm, a syntropic farm, because just looking at those plants, working together, it changes people's life, even if it's just for like 10 minutes. So an online course will never ever replace that. But I do have noticed that there isn't that many examples out there, and people do seem to be still a little bit unsure on how to go about. So what I'm thinking at the moment is just a thought, and I'm looking at the avenues on how to put it. How can we support those smallholders, you know, people that are like me, people that are just want to do the right thing, grow their own food, smaller scale. What kind of tools are available? What are the process that they can go through? What are the steps? You know, what do you mean by observing? You know, those kind of things where it kind of conceptually seems easy, but the reality is people are not perhaps too sure. So, and I think, you know, an online-based course could really support those people and support many other people that one, might not have an example close to home, or two, are just too busy to even go there. So I think the online, you know, has its problems, but it definitely has a lot of benefits. And especially for that smaller scale, people that are not so agro in tune, let's call it, that don't really know how to tie a tomato, you know, those little things that make a massive difference. So that's where I'm kind of thinking to go. How can we just support and allow this material that is presented in a coherent form, that people, you know, follow a process of knowledge as well, that they can then go implement their thing and go back. Because those principles, and it's, I mean, I'm experiencing this myself, going through a lot of material that I've collected over the years, that you kind of go, oh yeah, I forgot about this thing. Or not that you forget, but it's just not alive within you. So having those reference materials organized in a proper way that you can just go, I'm just going to refresh my memory here. I'm finding it great. I'm kind of, you know, even adapting my thoughts on what I'm going to be doing in spring. I'm like, oh, I think I'm going to chop everything. And you kind of read some material, go, no, maybe don't chop everything. Maybe leave some of those standing, that kind of stuff, you know? But yeah, look, it would be great if you can share that.
Yeah, happy to do that.
Yeah.
Look, I've got to say that, you know, there's, I've been out to your property a number of times, and I've seen it from, what is it, about 6 months of growth from when you started?
Not even. I think you were there. It was like 2.5 months.
Two and a half months, and I was amazed. And they started off in the middle of summer, was it? I remember you and Cindy were saying that you got up at like 4 a.m. and you were exhausted by 11 o'clock, but they've done an amazing thing. And the one thing that I'm even learning from Victor is that you just do need to observe the land, and then you can change your rationale. You can just, if you see something that's not working, you can change it. So it doesn't mean that you stick to one formula. This is definitely not, this is where you've got to learn to be in tune with the land and what it needs. And you do talk to plants, don't you?
You do.
You know, if you don't talk to the plants, they won't listen. And they will be speaking to you as well as to what they need. So this is really about a synergy or symbiotic process that we're going through. You know, that we all as humans need to learn. And, you know, from a sustainability perspective, I think this model that this road that you're going down is really one that is more sustainable than just planting a row of trees or plants to eat, you know, and just putting as much nitrogen into the soil, you know, not naturally. And then it just, you know, basically erodes your soil, and then next year you've got nothing. You've got to do the same thing again. But this is something that you're actually building a humus for your soil, and you will see an abundance in time of food for you and your family. And if you are into bigger productions, you can look at it that way as well.
Absolutely.
In terms of labor,
yeah,
right, for a bigger production, because, you know, look, people are supplying organic foods to supermarkets and so on. In terms of labor, is it cheaper doing it this way? And I'm talking about organics, because organics are...
Sure.
And I'm not talking about, you know, the row of tomatoes that have been harvested via, you know, machine. I'm talking about this, the organic food production.
Yeah, yeah. Look, the question of labor is a big one. I mean, it's undoubtedly more labor intensive just because you have so many more plants. So it's almost unfair to look at a syntropic system only from a cost perspective. I think like everything in life, it has to be a cost and a benefit. And of course, I think there is a big role for machinery to play with. And I am actually involved with a couple of friends, Scott Hall being one of them, on trying to come up with machinery that will allow bigger landholders to actually manage the organic matter, because that is kind of the high labor cost. Is how you process that organic matter, how do you organize it? Because if you just chop a piece of wood and leave it hanging, you know, it's not really gonna get there, because that piece of biomass, that piece of organic matter, that piece of stick needs to be in contact with the ground where life can take hold and moisture can take hold and life can, you know, take off. If you just leave it hanging, you know, it might have a little bit of termite and that's about it. So that does add a fair bit to the labor. And a few farms in Brazil who are going more into this agroforestry syntropic pathway are finding that it kind of, you know, how do you do it? Managing eucalyptus trees that are 5, 6, 7 meters tall, and then having to wood chip and that kind of stuff. So yeah, labor will be more. But, you know, on the other side, you know, people are producing a much higher quality produce, which attract by nature a much higher value as well. So your cost will be higher, but your produce should be much higher quality as well, which then attracts higher prices. I mean, there is a really good producer in Bolivia who's, you know, who's got the best orange in the market, and he's always the first one to sell for the highest price, because, you know, people are willing to pay for a nice orange that tastes like orange, not an apple that tastes like cardboard, or, you know, all those fruits and nuts and leafy greens that we are getting in the supermarket, which are just a water bomb. You know, they got nothing.
No, I agree, because I had a grapefruit that I bought at a supermarket that stayed on my tray for 3 months and it didn't go off. And that makes me wonder a little bit about that. But
yeah, I mean, the whole thing is that, unfortunately, the production system that we have now is dictated by the economy. So the economy dictates what needs to be grown, how fast and what to be transported. Well, syntropic farming goes into, you know, whoever dictates what's taking place is the ecology. And so by doing that, then we, with our intelligence, we can then find the economy that will support that. So, you know, if you're going to be selling to Coles and Woolies, then partnering with smaller retailers, you know, centers in Byron, or, you know, or farmers market people, you know, I think that is where we go. Local communities selling boxes and things like that. It's a great way of getting a higher value. Where you're actually selling to people that value good food.
Now, Victor, I just wonder if you could tell me about the cost benefit of, you know, doing syntropic farming.
Yeah, look, as we touched upon, for the big farmers, the difficulty for them to sell many crops. But I think by far the biggest cost benefit, when you put it on the paper, is for the individual, the household, the family to go there. I mean, people might think that, oh, but for me to produce, it might cost me that much in fertilizer and that much in this. And yes, there is a cost, which, if you're going to compare to a Coles, you know, to a supermarket product, it might actually have a higher cost, but the benefit on the individual level is just enormous. Not only are you going to get a much higher quality produce, which you cannot find anywhere. It doesn't really matter if somebody that's growing organic. You know, once you are there interacting with those plants, it's almost like there is this recognition from the plant of what you need, because you are recognizing the plant what it needs. So it's kind of almost a tailor-made food for you. And the taste is unbelievable. I don't want to need to go there how good your own grown carrots taste.
Oh, look, it's totally get that.
Yeah. It's off the charts. Yeah. I mean, the flavors. But then you start to add all those other qualities of interacting with the soil, of, you know, being out in nature, of, you know, just your mind resting for a bit, your body working, and then getting a reward for it, you know, and you worked for it. It's like 3 months later, you have this purple cauliflower and you just go like, whoa. You know, it's just every day there is a new good story, yeah, basically.
And I also found, and if you've got a family, it's a really good interaction, isn't it? Like, if you've got kids, they're in the ground, you know, they're not in front of a PlayStation or in front of a screen. They're actually doing something. They're actually interacting with the earth. And, you know, that's definitely brings a lot of, you know, families together doing that. You know, it's like doing the harvest or even planting seedlings, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there is nobody school, let's be honest. There is just so many examples of mathematics and history and geography that you can pluck out of a, you know, a little patch. And if you do it on a regular basis, I mean, part of my thinking and part of my practice now is how much does it take? How long does it take for a family to feed, you know, maybe two adults and two kids? I think perhaps, you know, a 10-meter bed every fortnight, you know, there might be maybe 10 hours a fortnight for the family, 5 hours each, or maybe 10 hours for the man, and, you know, maybe the woman might just enjoy harvesting, or the kids might enjoy harvesting, or if you have all the kids there, it's not even called work anymore. You know, it's kind of leisure time, and you can have a Barbie room, you know, happening as you do it. I think that's part of, you know, can we make growing food fun. It's a scale in which horticulture is fun. Whereas when you go into farms, doesn't really matter if they're organic or conventional, growing horticulture is painful. So it's the right scale in which is the healthiest, is the most fun, and yeah, it's the most benefit. So even though it might cost you a little bit more than supermarket, the benefit's just astronomical. That the cost actually disappears because it becomes entertainment. You know, it's a win.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, even if you live in an apartment, right?
Absolutely.
You could see if there's a way you can get a community garden together, you know, and that's another wonderful way to get together and do things as well, you know. So, you know, talk to your council and see if they have land that they can offer for a community garden. It's got to be good for the council to do that as well as for the community. And I know that in where we live, there's a couple of community gardens, one in Mullumbimby, there's one in Mwoolumbah.
Yep. There's one in UK.
Yeah. Yep. So there's a lot of opportunities, you know, so don't be limited, you know, in terms of doing things, because there is opportunities. Even if you do live in an apartment, there are things that you as a group, as a collective can do, and it really makes a difference in what the outcome's going to be. And, you know, going to be doing this together. Whilst I know we're in COVID-19 right now, but this is something you could start planning for, because this is not going to last forever.
Absolutely.
You know?
But even if you're workaholic crazy, that live in a suburban apartment, just get one of those little window pots, you know, buy a little bit of potting mix, go to your farmer's market and get six seedlings, just some herbs, and plant them.
Yeah.
You're going to get as much benefit as well. It's going to just help your mind grow with the plants. And once you harvest that little bit of parsley, you're going to get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Look, I really appreciate you coming on to Beaming Green Podcast today, Victor. So as I said, we will put your details on our website and try to attract people that would be interested in doing your course. Hopefully you do it. You never know, but at least you then, you know that there's some people interested in doing that. But thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having me here. I'm actually very excited about this course. I think it will come up. When? It's a matter of time.
Yeah.
And just one last advice for everybody out there is small and often.
Small and often.
Small and often. Just do a little bit on a regular basis. You know, we'll save you thousands of dollars. And I'll tell you what, I've spent thousands of dollars going big because you get excited that you can put all those plants together and things get a bit out of control. So small and often is the way to go for the big guy, for the little guy.
So thank you, Victor. And stay tuned for the next episode of Beaming Green. Thank you for being part of the Beaming Green podcast. The music for this podcast is produced by Dave Weir. Now, we need more people to get on board and raise awareness about sustainability and climate change. The more of us that are shining the light on these issues, the more governments and business leaders will listen. We would love you to subscribe to our podcast and share and engage in social media so that we can get some traction. Let's support one another and envision a brighter future. Thanks for listening and see you next week.